Now I am far from Thornfield. My home is a little cottage with whitewashed walls and a sanded floor. I am the proud schoolmistress of the village school at a salary of £30 a year. But I cannot forget.
Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. Dramatized for radio in 4 episodes by Micheline Wonder. Starring Sophie Thompson as Jane Eyre, Kieran Hines as Mr. Rochester, and John Dutteen as St. John Rivers, with Anne Stallybrass and Angela Down. Episode 4, Jane the Wife.
Would it have been better to listen to passion, sunk down in a silken snare, wakened in a southern clime amongst the luxuries of a villa in France? Mr. Rochester's mistress, delirious with his love. He did love me. No one will ever love me so well again.
Good evening, Miss Elliot.
Oh, but good evening, Mr. Rivers.
My sister asked me to bring this parcel to you. It contains a colour box, pencils and paper.
Oh, that is a welcome gift.
Are you finding your work hard?
No, on the contrary. I think in time I shall get on with my scholars very well.
But perhaps your accommodation, your cottage, your furniture have disappointed your expectations.
My cottage is clean and waterproof. My furniture sufficient and commodious. I am thankful. 5 weeks ago, I had nothing. I was an outcast, a beggar. Now I have acquaintances, a home. You and Diana have been my saviors.
I hope you feel the content you express. Where you were before I saw you, of course, I do not know. But I counsel you to resist every temptation which would incline you to look back on your past life, whatever it is.
That is what I mean to do.
A year ago, I myself was intensely miserable because I thought I had made a mistake in entering the ministry. I burned for the more active life of the world, for the destiny of an artist, anything rather than that of a priest. After a season of darkness and light, struggling, relief fell. I heard a call from heaven, and I resolved to be a missionary.
I see. Good evening, Mr. Rivers.
Oh, Miss Oliver.
Papa told me you had opened your school. And so I put on my bonnet after tea and came up the valley to see her.
Well, this is the school and this is Miss Elliot.
Ah, the teacher. Do you think you shall like Morton, Miss Elliot?
I hope I shall.
Do you find your scholars as attentive as you expected?
Oh, yes.
And do you like your house?
Very much.
Have I furnished it nicely?
Very nicely indeed. Oh, thank you. I did not realize
that you... I come up and help you teach sometimes. It will be a change for me. Mr. Rivers, Papa says you never come up to see us now. He is alone this evening and not very well. Will you return with me and visit him?
It is not a reasonable hour to intrude on Mr.
Oh, but I declare it is. It is just the hour when Papa most wants company, when the works are closed and he has no business to occupy him. Oh, Mr. Rivers, do come. Why are you so very shy and so very somber?
Not this evening, Miss Rosamond, if you will excuse me.
Well, if you are so obstinate, I will leave you, for I dare not stay any longer. The dew begins to fall. Good evening. I continue the labours of the village school. It is truly hard work at first, but soon I begin to like the children, and they like me. And yet, in the midst of this calmness, this useful existence, after a day passed in honourable exertion and an evening spent drawing or reading alone, I rush into strange dreams at night. Again and again I meet Mr. Rochester. I am in his arms. I hear his voice. I meet his eye. I touch his hand and cheek. I love him. I am loved by him. The still dark night witnesses the convulsion of despair, the burst of passion. And by 9 the next morning, I am opening the school. Tranquil, settled, prepared for the steady duties of the day. Rosamond Oliver visits often, exquisite in a purple habit, with a cap of black velvet placed gracefully above the long curls that kiss her cheek and float to her shoulders.
I know I seem absolutely spoiled, but I am not, Miss Elliot. I am hasty but good-humoured. I cannot help being vain.
But not affected.
Liberal-handed.
Innocent, with the pride of wealth.
You understand me well. You are a natural as the village schoolmistress. I am sure your previous history, if it were known, would make a delightful romance. Now, what is this? Why, you draw better than my drawing master in my first school. Would you sketch a portrait of me to show to Papa?
With pleasure.
What must I do?
Be as comfortable as you like, and keep your pose for me.
There. The Rivers family is greatly respected in this neighbourhood. It is a very old name. Did you know that all Morton once belonged to them?
Oh, no, I did not. Mm.
It is a pity that so fine and talented a young man should have formed the design of going out as a missionary. It is quite throwing a valuable life away.
He will do as he thinks right, Miss Oliver. There. I have your outline. That will do for today, I think.
Come in.
Miss Elliot.
You are welcome, Mr. Rivers. Do sit down.
Oh, I'm afraid I cannot stay long.
Well, at least come in for a moment.
What are you drawing?
See for yourself. Is it a good likeness?
Miss Oliver, I presume.
Of course. And now, sir, to reward you for the accurate guess, I will promise to paint you a careful and faithful duplicate of this very picture.
That I should like to have it, it is certain. Whether it would be judicious or wise is another question.
As far as I can see, it would be wiser and more judicious if you were to take to yourself the original at once.
I see.
You are not angry or shocked?
To be frankly addressed on this subject is a new pleasure.
She likes you, I am sure. She is a sweet girl. Rather thoughtless, but you would have sufficient thought for both yourself and her. You ought to marry her.
It is strange. While I love Rosamond Oliver wildly with the intensity of a first passion, I experience at the same time a consciousness that she would not make me a good wife. She is not the partner suited to me.
Strange indeed.
Rosamond, a missionary's wife? No.
But you need not be a missionary.
What? My vocation, my great work, it is dearer than the blood in my veins.
And Miss Oliver, are her disappointments and sorrows of no interest to you?
Miss Oliver is surrounded by suitors and countrymen. In less than a month, my image will be effaced from her heart.
You speak coolly enough, but you suffer in the conflict.
I did not imagine that a woman would dare speak so to a man.
I am at home in this sort of discourse.
There is something brave in your spirit. But you misinterpret my emotions. You think them more profound, potent than they are. I scorn the weakness of the flesh. I am a cold, hard man.
I do not believe you.
Now, I must go.
And may I paint another picture for you?
No, you may not.
What is the matter?
Nothing in the world. May I have a scrap of this paper?
Why, yes, of course.
Good afternoon.
That evening, it begins to snow. Next day, a keen wind brings fresh and blinding falls. By twilight, the valley is drifted up and almost impassable. I light a candle, take down a book.
Oh! I did not expect any guests tonight. Has anything happened, Mr. Rivers?
No. Did I alarm you?
Well, I...
You must excuse me. I have had hard work to get here. One drift took me up to the west.
But why are you come? It is so late.
I have come to have a little talk with you. Since yesterday, I have experienced the excitement of a person to whom a tale has been half told and who is impatient to hear the sequel.
Well?
It is but fair to warn you that the story will sound somewhat hackneyed in your ears. May I sit down?
Oh, of course. I will fetch some tea. Please, begin your story.
Thank you. 20 years ago, a poor curate fell in love with a rich man's daughter. They married against the advice of all her friends, who disowned her immediately after the wedding. Before 2 years passed, they were both dead. They left a daughter. Charity carried this friendless thing to the house of its rich paternal relations. It was reared by an aunt-in-law called Mrs. Reed of Gateshead. Shall I proceed?
Yes, if you please.
Mrs. Reed kept the orphan 10 years. Whether it was happy or not with her, I cannot say. But at the end of that time, she transferred it to Lowood School, where you so long resided yourself. It seemed her career there was very honorable. From a pupil, she became a teacher, like yourself. She left to be a governess. Really, there are parallel points in her history and yours. She undertook the education of the ward of a certain Mr. Rochester.
Mr. Rivers!
I can get your feelings, but restrain them for a while. I have nearly finished. Of Mr. Rochester's character, I know nothing but the one fact that he offered honorable marriage to this young girl, and that at the very altar she discovered he had a wife alive, though lunatic. She left Thornfield Hall in the night. The country was scoured far and wide. No vestige of information could be gathered respecting her. Yet it is a matter of serious urgency that she should be found.
Since you know so much, tell me this. What of Mr. Rochester? How and where is he? What is he doing? Is he well?
I am ignorant of all concerning Mr. Rochester. You should rather ask the name of the governess and the nature of the event which requires her appearance.
Someone has been in touch with Mr. Rochester?
Of course, by letter.
Well, what did he say? Who has his letter?
Mr. Briggs put an advertisement in the newspaper. The reply was not from Mr. Rochester. It was signed Alice Fairfax.
My worst fears are true. He must have got away. Please continue.
Very well. I shall finish my tale. Since you won't ask the governess's name, I must tell it of my own accord. Do you recognize this?
Why, yes. It is a slip of paper on which I have tried my colors.
There. Look. A name. Jane Eyre.
Oh.
Mr. Briggs wrote to me of a Jane Eyre. I knew a Jane Elliot. I confess I had my suspicions, but it was only yesterday afternoon that they were at once resolved as a certainty. You own this name?
Yes, I do. But where is Mr. Briggs? Perhaps he knows more of Mr. Rochester than you do.
You do not inquire why Mr. Briggs seeks after you, what he wants?
Well, what does he want?
To tell you that your uncle, Mr. Eyre of Madeira, is dead. And that he has left you all his property, and that you are now rich.
I rich?
Yes. Quite an heiress.
I see.
You must prove your identity, of course. You can then enter immediate position.
My uncle is dead. My only relative. Ever since being made aware of his existence, how I have cherished the hope of one day seeing him. And now I never shall. That is sad.
Perhaps you will ask how much you are worth.
Oh, yes.
Oh, a trifle. Nothing to speak of. £20,000, I think, or so, but what is that?
£20,000? Well, perhaps you've read the figures wrong. It may be 2,000.
It is written in letters, not figures. Look, 20,000.
I see. Well, it puzzles me to know why Mr. Briggs wrote to you about me.
Oh, I am a clergyman, and the clergy are often appealed to in odd matters.
That does not satisfy me.
Well, then, I yield. Your name is Jane Eyre.
Of course, that was settled before.
You are not perhaps aware that I am your namesake. That I was christened St. John Eyre Rivers.
No, indeed.
My mother's name was Eyre. She had two brothers, one a clergyman, the other John Eyre of Madeira. Mr. Briggs, being Mr. Eyre's solicitor, he wrote to us last August to inform us of our uncle's death and to say that he had left all his property to his brother's orphan daughter. He wrote to ask us if we knew anything of the heiress.
Your mother was my father's sister.
Yes.
My aunt, consequently.
Indeed.
You and Diana are my cousins.
We are cousins, yes.
Oh. Oh. That is good news indeed. I have found a brother. One I can be proud of. One I can love. And a sister who has inspired me with genuine affection and admiration. Oh, this is a glorious discovery. This is wealth indeed. Oh, I am glad. I am so glad. Oh, £20,000 shared between us will leave us all content.
My dear, sit down, please, and be composed.
Will torment and oppress me, dear. £20,000, which could never be mine in justice, though it might be in law. Let there be no opposition, no discussion. Let us agree.
You must take time to consider. It is yours, of right. You may keep it with a clear conscience.
It is as much a matter of feeling as of conscience. I so seldom have had an opportunity of indulging my feelings. I cannot forego the delicious pleasure of repaying your generosity.
You cannot form a notion of the importance £20,000 would give you, of the place it would enable you to take in society, of the prospects it would open up to you.
And you cannot at all imagine the craving I have for fraternal and sisterly love. I never had a home. I never had brothers or sisters. I must and I will have them now. You are not reluctant to admit me and own me, are you?
Jane, your aspirations after family ties and domestic happiness may be realized otherwise than by the means you contemplate. You may marry.
Oh, nonsense. I do not want to marry and never shall
that
marry.
That is saying too much.
I know what I feel. And how averse my inclinations are to the bare thought of marriage. No one would take me for love, and I will not be regarded in the light of a mere money speculation. I do not want a stranger. I want my kindred.
And the school, Miss Eyre? It must now be shut up, I suppose.
No! I will retain my post as mistress till you get a substitute.
Thank you.
I shall get matters regarding the legacy settled, and we shall each become possessed of a competency, and then...
What now? What sudden eagerness is this? What are you going to do?
Well, my first aim
dream will be to clean down your house from chamber to cellar. My next arrangement would be flax oil and an indefinite number of cloths till it glitters. My third, to arrange every chair, table, bed and carpet with mathematical precision. And afterwards I shall go to near ruining you in cold and peat to keep up good fires in every room. And lastly, there will be such a beating of eggs, sorting of currants, grating of spices, compounding of Christmas cake, chopping up of materials for mince pies and other culinary rites, to have all things in an absolutely perfect state of readiness for my first holiday with my own family. For we shall all live together now.
And so my life changes again. I move in to live with St. John Rivers and Diana. Diana and I are happy from morning till night. St. John is seldom in the house. His parish is large, the population scattered, and he finds daily business in visiting the sick and poor in different districts. He is a good man, but I begin to feel he spoke the truth when he said he was harsh and cold. The peaceful enjoyments of life have no charm for him. He lives only to aspire after what is good and great. I expect he will hardly make a good husband. He is of the material from which nature hews her heroes.
Jane, I have a request to make of you.
What is it?
My departure from England is now definitely fixed for next year.
Oh, really?
And Rosamond Oliver?
Rosamond Oliver is about to be married to Mr. Granby, one of the best connected and most eligible residents. I had the intelligence from her father yesterday. They will be married soon.
Does the event distress you?
No. Certainly not. But my request, Jane.
Yes, St. John.
I am at present studying Hindustani, and it will assist me greatly to have a pupil with whom I might go over the elements and so fix them thoroughly in my mind. Would you do me this favor? You shall not have to make the sacrifice long, as it wants now barely 3 months to my departure.
Very well, St. John. It will interest me. By degrees, St. John acquires a certain influence over me that takes away my liberty of mind. His praise and notice are more restraining than his indifference. I can no longer talk or laugh freely when he is by, because I am reminded that vivacity is distasteful to him. One day, as we work at our books, his Greek face is brought to a level with mine. And he kisses me. I am sure I do not blush. Perhaps I might have turned a little pale. And although I daily wish more to please him, Mr. Rochester is still in my heart. His is a name given on a tablet, fated to last as long as the marvel it describes. The craving to know what has become of him follows me everywhere. I write to Mrs. Fairfax. A fortnight passes without reply. I write again. Half a year is wasted, waiting. My hope dies out. And then I feel dark indeed. The first spring shines around me. Summer approaches.
We have studied enough today. Jane, you should take a walk with me.
Very well.
I shall see this place again in dreams when I sleep by the Ganges And again in the more remote hour when another slumber overcomes me on the shore of a darker stream.
Strange words.
Jane, I go in 6 weeks. I have taken my berth.
God will protect you, for you have undertaken his work.
Yes, I am the servant of an infallible master. It seems strange to me that all around me do not burn to enlist the same banner, to join in the same enterprise.
All have not your powers. It would be folly for the feeble to wish to march with the strong.
I do not speak to the feeble or think of them. I address only such as are worthy of the work.
Those are few in number and difficult to discover.
Indeed. But it is right to stir them up, to speak heaven's message in their ear, to offer them, direct from God, a place in the ranks of his chosen.
If they are really qualified for the task, will not their own hearts be the first to inform them of it?
And what does your heart say?
My heart is mute.
Then I must speak for it. Jane, come with me to India. Come as my helpmate and fellow laborer.
But I am no apostle.
God and nature intended you for a missionary's wife. You shall be mine. I claim you not for my pleasure, but for my sovereign service.
I am not fit for it. I have no vocation.
Who is fit for it? I am the chiefest of sinners. But I know my leader. He is just as well as mighty.
Well, I might go to India if I may go free.
I do not understand you.
You have hitherto been my adopted brother, and I your adopted sister. Let us continue as such.
Adopted fraternity will not do. If you were my real sister, it would be different. But as it is, either our union must be consecrated and sealed by marriage, or it cannot exist. Do you not see it, Jane?
St. John, I regard you as a brother.
We cannot. It would not do. You have said you will go with me to India. Remember, you have said that.
Conditionally.
I do not want a sister. I want a wife. Someone I can influence sufficiently in life and retain absolutely till death.
I will give the missionary my energies, but not myself.
Do you think God would be satisfied with half a sacrifice?
Oh, I will give my heart to God. You do not want it.
I trust, Jane, you are in earnest when you say you will give your heart to God. It is all I want. You will see what impetus will be given to your efforts and mine by our physical and mental union in marriage. You will hasten to enter into that union at once when you think...
I can never be your wife. I could be your curate, your comrade.
Jane, you would not repent marrying me. Be certain of that. Undoubtedly, enough of love would follow upon marriage to render the union right, even in your eyes.
I scorn your idea of love. I scorn the counterfeit sentiments you offer, and I scorn you when you offer it.
I think I have done and uttered nothing to deserve scorn.
Forgive me, St. John, but it is your own fault that I have been roused to speak so unguardedly. You have introduced a topic on which our natures are at variance. My dear cousin, abandon your scheme of marriage, please. I implore you.
I shall urge you no further at present. Tomorrow I leave for Cambridge. I shall be absent a fortnight. Take that space of time to consider my offer.
No, St. John. I will not marry you. I can tell now. I adhere to my resolution. If I were to marry you, you would kill me.
I should kill you? Your words are such as ought not to be used. Violent, unfeminine, and untrue. They merit severe reproof. You are afraid of yourself.
I am. God did not give me my life to throw away. To do as you wish me, would I begin to think be almost the equivalent to committing suicide. Moreover, before I definitely resolve on quitting England, I must know for certain that I cannot be of greater use by remaining in it than by leaving it.
What do you mean?
There is a point on which I have long endured painful doubt, and I can go nowhere until by some means that doubt is removed.
You mean Mr. Rochester?
Yes.
Are you going to see him?
I must find out what has become of him.
You will excuse me.
Jane, what is it? You look agitated. I'm sure there is something the matter. Is it... St. John has long distinguished you by a notice and interest he never showed to anyone else. I wish he loved you. Does he, Jane?
No, Diana, not one whit. But he has asked me to marry him.
That is just what I hoped. And you will marry him, Jane, won't you? Then you will stay in England.
Far from that, Diana. His sole idea in proposing to me is to procure a fitting fellow labourer in his Indian toils.
What? He wishes you to go to India?
Yes.
That is madness. You have not consented, have you?
I have refused to marry him.
And consequently displeased him?
Deeply. He will never forgive me, I fear. I offered to accompany him as a sister.
Oh, Jane. I am astonished you found courage to refuse his hand. You do not love him then, Jane?
Not as a husband.
Yet he is a handsome fellow.
And I am so plain. You see, Diana, we should never suit.
Plain? You? Not at all.
He is a good and a great man. But in pursuing his own views, he forgets pitilessly the feelings and claims of other people. It is better, therefore, for the insignificant to keep out of his way, lest in his progress he should trample them down.
For the reading before prayers, I have selected the 21st chapter of Revelations. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the fearful, the unbelieving, shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death.
What is my future?
I supplicate strength for the weak-hearted, guidance for wanderers from the fold, a return, even at the 11th hour, for those whom the temptations of the world and the flesh are luring from the narrow path.
I can be saved. I can be safe.
Jane. Come, Jane, decide.
Safety and bliss. No more dangerous passion.
Jane, come to me.
The candle is dying out. My room is full of moonlight. My heart beats fast and thick. I hear its throb.
Jane.
Oh.
What is it? Jane.
Jane. Jane.
Oh, Edward.
Come with me.
Where are you?
I'm coming. Wait for me.
Jane.
Listen to me.
Where are you?
Where are you?
At dawn, I arrange things in my room. Under my door, I find a slip of paper.
You left me too suddenly last night. Had you stayed but a little longer, you would have laid your hand on a Christian's cross and the angel's crown. I shall expect your clear decision when I return this day fortnight. I shall pray for you hourly. Yours, St. John.
Once more on the road to Thornfield. I feel like the messenger pigeon flying home. I set out from Whitcross on a Tuesday afternoon, and early on the succeeding Thursday morning, the coach stops to water the horses in a wayside inn, in the midst of green hedges and large fields, which bathe my eye like the lineaments of a once familiar face. How far is Thornfield Hall from here?
Just 2 miles now across the fields.
I shall walk. Would you keep my box until I call for it?
Certainly, ma'am.
I walk over familiar paths. There is the stile. The very field through which I hurried, blind and deaf, on the morning I fled from Thornfield. I walk fast. I run. I welcome trees I know and catch familiar glimpses of meadow and hill between them.
The woods. Another field. A lane. The house itself is hidden by the rookery. My first view of it shall be in front, where its bold battlements will strike the eye nobly at once. Perhaps even now he is walking in the orchard. Hurry! Hurry!
Jane!
I hurry along the wall of the orchard to the gate. I look with joy towards a stately house. I see a blackened ruin. No need to listen for doors opening, to fancy steps on the pavement or the gravel walk. The lawn is trodden and waste.
No more.
The front is as I saw it once, in a dream. A shell-like wall, very high and fragile looking, perforated with painless windows. The signs of fire everywhere.
No more.
What story belongs to this disaster?
Your breakfast now.
Thank you. You know Thornfield Hall, of course.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Is Mr. Rochester living at Thornfield Hall now?
Oh, no. No one's living there. Thornfield Hall is quite a ruin. It was burnt down about harvest time. Dreadful calamity.
What happened?
When the fire broke out at dead of night, before long the building was one mass of flames. Ooh, it was a terrible sight.
Where did the fire start?
There was a lady, a lunatic, kept in the house.
Indeed.
She was kept in very close confinement, ma'am. No one saw her. We only knew by rumour that such a person was at the hall. They said Mr. Edward had brought her from abroad, and some believed she'd been his mistress. But then this lady, ma'am, turned out to be Mr. Rochester's wife. The discovery was brought about in the strangest way. There was a young lady, the governess at the hall, that Mr. Rochester fell in love...
Yes, but the fire...
Yes, I'm coming to that, ma'am. Mr. Edward fell in love with the young lady... Servants say they never saw anybody so much in love as he was. Well, he would marry her.
Was it suspected that this lunatic, Mrs. Rochester, had any hand in the fire?
Oh, yes. She had a woman to take care of her called Mrs. Poole. And when Mrs. Poole was fast asleep, the mad lady took the keys, let herself out of her chamber, went roaming about the house, doing any wild mischief that came into her head. They say she nearly burned her husband in his bed once.
Was Mr. Rochester at home when the fire broke out?
Oh, indeed he was. He went up to the attic when all was burning and got the servants out of the beds and helped them down himself and went back to get his mad wife out of her cell.
Free. At last. And then?
Then, ma'am, she yelled and gave a spring, and next minute she lay on the pavement.
Dead?
Dead as the stones on which her brains and blood were scattered.
Good God.
It was frightful.
And afterwards?
The house was burnt to the ground.
Were any other lives lost?
No. Oh, perhaps it would have been better if they had.
He is alive, then.
Yes, he is alive.
And?
It was all his own courage and his kindness in a way, ma'am. When he came down the great staircase at last, there was a mighty crash. He was taken out from the ruins, alive, but sadly hurt. A beam, a damaged one eye and one hand was crushed.
Where is he?
At Ferndean, manor house about 30 miles away.
If you can drive me to Ferndean before dark, I'll pay you twice the usual hire. Thick and dark grows the timber of the gloomy wood about the manor house. Iron gates between granite pillars. The twilight of close-ranked trees. A grass-grown track descends the forest aisle. Under branched arches, it stretches and winds. A railing, then the house. Dank and green, decaying walls. No flowers, no garden. A broad gravel walk girdling a grass plot. The windows are latticed and narrow. A figure. A man without a hat. He stretches forth his hand to feel whether it rains. Edward Fairfax Rochester. Still strong and stalwart. His hair still black. But his face is desperate and brooding, like some fettered or wild bird. Soon I shall dare to drop a kiss on that brow and on those lips so sternly sealed. He advances slowly towards the grass plot. He stretches his right hand. The left one he keeps hidden in his coat.
Will you come in, sir? You will catch cold.
How are you?
Why, Jane Eyre, is it really you?
It is.
Oh, oh, it is so good to see you. Oh, oh, come in, come in.
Thank you.
That will be Mr. Rochester.
Let me go into him.
But, Jane, I must...
I know everything. Give me his tray and whatever he wants.
He always has candles brought in at dark, though he cannot see. Let me open the door for you.
Right down, Paddy.
What is the commotion? Give me some water, Mrs. Fairfax.
Here you are.
What is the matter? Mrs. Fairfax.
Mrs. Fairfax is in the kitchen.
Who are you?
Pilot knows me.
Great God. What sweet madness has seized me?
Your mind, sir, is too strong for delusion. Your health too sound for frenzy.
Come here.
Here is my hand. Give me yours.
Her fingers. Her small hand. It's a chain. It's her chain.
And this, her voice, her heart, too. She is all here. Oh, God bless you, Edward. I am so glad to be near you again.
Jane Eyre.
I have found you out. I have come back to you. You touch me. You hold me. I am not cold like a corpse, nor vacant like air, am I?
My living darling, I cannot be so blessed after all my misery. It's a dream. I will wake and you'll be gone.
I will never leave you from this day. There. And there. And there.
You do not lie dead in some ditch or under some stream.
No.
Oh. Oh.
I am an independent woman now.
Independent? What do you mean?
My uncle in Madeira is dead.
and he left me money.
An independent woman. And a rich woman.
Quite rich. If you won't let me live with you, I can build a house of my own, close up to your door, and you may come and sit in my parlour when you want company of an evening.
But as you are rich, Jane, you have no doubt friends who will look after you and not suffer you to devote yourself to a blind thing like me.
I told you, I am independent as well as rich. I am my own mistress.
You will stay with me.
Certainly. Unless you object, I will be your neighbour, your nurse, your housekeeper. I will read to you, walk with you, sit with you, wait on you, be eyes and hands to you.
I do not know what to say.
Perhaps you do not want me.
But no, Jane, no. I have touched you, heard you. Felt the comfort of your presence. I cannot give up these joys.
Well, then, I will stay with you. I have said so.
Yes, but you understand one thing by staying with me, and I understand another. Perhaps you could make up your mind to wait on me as a kind little nurse. That ought to suffice for me, no doubt. I suppose I should entertain none but fatherly feelings for you. Do you think so? Come, tell me.
I am content to be only your nurse if you think it better.
But you cannot always be my nurse, Jane. You are young. You must marry someday.
I don't care about being married.
You should care, Jane.
Now, let me make a better fire and have the hearth swept up. Can you tell when there is a good fire?
Yes. With my right eye, I see a glow, a ruddy haze.
Can you see candles?
Very dimly.
Can you see me?
No. My fairest, but I am only too thankful to hear and feel you.
When do you take supper?
Oh, I never take supper.
But you shall have some tonight. I am hungry, and so are you. Oh, it is so good to hear you laugh.
Oh, I have not laughed for a long time. Am I hideous, Jade?
You always were, you know.
All the wickedness has not been taken out of you, wherever you've been.
I have been with good people.
Were there only ladies in the house where you've been?
No. There was my cousin, St. John Rivers, a parson, a good man.
Oh, a respectable, well-conducted man of 50.
St. John is only 29.
A sort of raw curate, half-strangled with his white neckcloth.
St. John is a handsome man, tall, fair, with blue eyes and a Grecian profile.
Damn him! Did you like him, Jane?
Yes, Mr. Rochester. I liked him. Are you jealous?
Not at all. Talk to me of yourself.
There is time to talk. Tomorrow, we will walk in the woods. What are you thinking?
I was thinking that I am no better than the old chestnut tree that was struck by lightning. Do you remember in Thornfield Orchard? In what right would that ruin have to bid a budding woodbine cover its decay with freshness?
You are no ruin, no lightning-struck tree. You are green and vigorous. Plants will grow about you whether you ask them or not, because they take delight in your beautiful shadow, and as they grow, they will lean towards you and wind around you.
You speak of friends, Jane.
Yes, Edward, friends.
But, Jane, I want a wife.
Do you?
Yes. Is that unwelcome news?
That depends on the circumstances and on your choice.
Which you shall make for me, Jane. I will abide by your decision.
Choose she who loves you best.
I will at least choose she whom I love best. Jane,
Will you marry me?
Yes, Edward.
A poor blind man whom you will have to lead about by the hands?
Yes, Edward.
A crippled man 20 years older than you and whom you will have to wait?
Yes.
Truly, Jane?
Yes, truly, Edward.
Oh, my darling. God bless and reward you.
If ever I did a good deed in my life, if ever I thought a good thought, prayed a sincere and blameless prayer, if ever I wished a righteous wish, I am rewarded now. To be your wife is for me to be as happy as I can be on this earth.
Because you delight in sacrifice.
What do I sacrifice? Famine for food. Expectation for content, to be privileged, to put my arms around what I value, to press my lips to what I love, to repose on what I trust. Is that to make a sacrifice? If so, then yes, I certainly delight in sacrifice.
And to bear with my infirmities, Jane, to overlook my deficiencies.
They are none to me. I love you better now that I can be really useful to you than I ever did in your state of proud independence.
The case being so, we have nothing in the world to wait for.
Let us go home through the woods.
The last days have been strange, Jane. Now, on Monday, a singular mood came over me in which grief replaced frenzy. I had long had the impression that since I could nowhere find you, you must be dead. And late that night, ere I retired, I supplicated God that if it seemed good to him, I might soon be taken from this life. I was in my room by an open window. It soothed me to feel the night air. I could see no stars, and only by a vague, luminous haze knew the presence of the moon. But I longed for you, Jane, both with body and soul. I asked of God at once, in anguish and humility, that if I had not been long enough desolate, afflicted, tormented, and might not soon taste bliss and peace once more, I pleaded, and my heart's wishes broke involuntarily from my lips in the words, Jane! Jane!
Did you speak those words aloud?
I did. If any listener had heard me, they would have thought me mad.
Last Monday night, somewhere near midnight?
What followed is the strangest thing. You will think me superstitious, but as I exclaimed your name, a voice replied, I am coming. Wait for me. And then, where are you? Perhaps your soul wandered from itself to comfort mine, for that was your voice, as certain as I live.
Strange indeed.
You cannot now wonder that when you came upon me so unexpectedly last night, I had difficulty in believing you other than a mere voice and vision, something that would melt to annihilation as a midnight whisper.
I am your whisper at night and your voice during the day. Come, Edward, let us go home. Quiet wedding we had. He and I, the parson and clerk, were alone present. This time there were no rude interruptions, no impediments. This time the service was peaceful and the promises heartfelt. When we got back from the church, I told Mrs. Fairfax.
Oh, Jane, my dear, I am delighted. I wish you both joy. You deserve it.
I wrote to Diana, who promised to come and visit once the honeymoon was over.
She had better not wait till then, Jane, for our honeymoon will shine our life long.
St. John continued to write to me from India, but without ever mentioning Mr. Rochester's name or alluding to my marriage. And little Adela.
I am not happy at my school, mademoiselle.
I found her a school conducted on a more indulgent system, where I could visit her often. She will never want for anything. I know now what it is to live entirely with and for what I love best on earth. Edward and I know no weariness in each other's company. He sees nature. He reads books through me. No woman was closer to her love than I am. One morning, at the end of 2 years,
Jane, do you have a glittering ornament round your neck?
Yes. I'm wearing a gold chain.
And are you wearing a pale blue dress?
Indeed, I am. Oh, Edward!
The sky is no longer a blank. The earth no longer a void.
That was the final episode of Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte, dramatized for radio by Micheline Wonder. Jane Eyre was played by Sophie Thompson, Mr. Rochester by Kieran Hines, and St. John Rivers by John Dutteen. Mrs. Fairfax was played by Anne Scalibras, Diana by Angela Dahn, Miss Oliver by Melinda Walker, Adela by Una Beeson, Bertha by Vivian Rochester, and the driver and host by Gareth Armstrong. Technical presentation was by Richard Beedsmore, Mike Efferdon, and Alison McKenzie. Jane Eyre was directed by Cherry Cookson.